Welcome to the Uphill Athlete Podcast. These programs are just one of several free services we provide to disseminate information about training for mountain sports. If you like what you hear and want more, please check out our website, uphillathlete.com, where you'll find many articles and our extensive video library on all aspects of training for and accomplishing a variety of mountain goals. You'll also find our forum, where you can ask questions of our experts and the community at large. Our email is coach@uphillathlete.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Welcome to another episode of the Uphill Athlete Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Johnston, co-founder of Uphill Athlete. And today it gives me great pleasure to have one of my truly dear friends on the podcast with me, Larry Goldie. And Larry and I go quite a ways back and have had a lot of interesting adventures in the mountains together. So Larry is a fully certified IFMGA guide. He is also one of the lead examiners for the AMGA for guides examination. He's an ARI, which is an what is the acronym for ARI? What does that stand for?
ARI stands for the American Institute of Avalanche Research and Education.
Okay, so Larry is he's a trainer of the instructors for those courses, and he also leads all their pro courses. He's been guiding for 25 years. He's also the snow safety director and lead guide for North Cascades heli-skiing. And he's a co-owner at North Cascades Mountain Guides, and they do a lot of ski touring guiding in the winter as well. And what I wanted to talk with Larry about is ski touring. And what I have noticed, and I think anybody who's been out in the mountains this winter has noticed, this explosion of the number of people who are out there on ski touring gear. And I think that's resulted in a lot of changes, certainly in our little area, Larry, I think you'd agree, that has really changed the character of the place. And, you know, I wanted to hear from you what you see and what you perceive as, you know, some of the positives and the negatives of that. But thanks a lot for joining me.
Yeah. Oh, it's great to be here, Scott. I'd start out by saying that the explosion in backcountry skiing has really been happening for a number of years now. If you look in the trends within the outdoor industry, sales of backcountry gear has been really, you know, on the sharp rise for quite a few years now. And then this year, I think we're seeing an even bigger surge in that, largely just because of the situation we're dealing with in the country right now, in the world, with COVID. So the ski areas are limiting numbers, and the safest place to be is outside. Everyone's been cooped up for almost a year now. So backcountry skiing is kind of an obvious way for people to get out, recreate with friends. It, you know, being on skis just lends itself to social distancing. By default, I think we're seeing this giant increase this year in particular. People that have thought about it in the past have decided this is going to be the year. And so not just in our area, but throughout the country, I hear stories from, you know, friends that I have in all the different mountainous regions around the country, and everyone's seeing the same incredible surge in the use of the backcountry.
And I would imagine that both North Cascades Mountain Guides and North Cascades Heli Skiing have seen a bump in their business as well, haven't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. North Cascades Mountain Guides, you know, we also teach recreational avalanche courses, and we historically have limited ourselves to just a couple courses a year. We've taken the approach that there are plenty of avalanche course providers in the Northwest, and we're a little bit off the beaten track here in the Metau. It's hard for people to get here. And by that same token, it's hard for people that are here to go anywhere else. So we've always felt like if people living in the valley want to take an avalanche course, then we don't want them to have to leave the valley to do it. But we're not necessarily trying to compete with all the companies based out of Western Washington that really meet the needs of all the people in the Puget Sound region. That said, we have had more requests for avalanche courses this year, largely by locals, but even people from Seattle who we tried to dissuade and say, no, you should take a course on the west side of the mountains. But they've still wanted to come here, and we run more avalanche courses this year than, you know, in any year in the past, as well as we've had, you know, guides working almost every single day of the winter this year, which is, that's a rarity for us in the past. Heli-ski operation here is also dealing with kind of historic bookings. And I think that has a lot to do with people's inability to travel. You know, so many skiers like to go up to Canada, especially for helicopter skiing. You know, there's so many mechanized operations up there. And with us not being able to cross the border into Canada, now all those people are locked into north or into the the U.S. south of the border and are looking for heli operations here. So our phone there has been ringing off the hook as well.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have, I suppose, as a business owner. Yeah, it's not a bad position to find yourself in.
It's not. Although, you know, we want to be responsible and respectful of the fact that it is getting more crowded out there. And so, you know, at NCMG, the company where I take part in some of the management decisions, you know, we have limited the number of guided guests that we'll have out in the field on any given day, just so, you know, so we're not sort of overburdening the resource in the backcountry just by taking too many people out there. So, it's a good problem to have, but to some degree, it still is a problem because more and more people are out there. Thank goodness this year we've been in this La Nina pattern where we've been getting pretty regular snowfalls and, when it snows frequently enough that everything keeps getting refreshed, then you don't have this issue of scarcity where everybody's competing for, you know, the same untracked slopes. When it snows every few days, those same untracked slopes remain untracked and everybody can find what they're looking for every day. So.
Sorry. What are some of the downsides that you see both currently and potentially in the future with this, you know, increased usage that we're seeing?
Well, you know, one of the things that we're seeing this year, even though on the one hand, I just said so many people are taking avalanche courses, we're still seeing a lot of people out there who, you know, to be perfectly honest, I have no idea whether or not they've taken an avalanche course, but clearly by the decisions they're making, they're quite inexperienced and, you know, aren't always making the best decisions. You know, in general, it's harder to trigger an avalanche than, you know, we're sometimes led to believe. And in general, especially here in the Northwest, we have a pretty benevolent snowpack. So it's easy for people to get lucky and think that they're actually making pretty good decisions when in fact they're making poor decisions, but they're getting lucky. And so, you know, already this year, I've seen that more than a few times of people doing things they really shouldn't be doing on certain days, but they're getting lucky and they're being rewarded, you know, because they're not getting feedback that that was a poor decision, at least from the snowpack. They might get it from me. Right. More often than not, I generally don't, you know, offer unsolicited advice like that, but I have been seeing that out there. We're just seeing a lot of people. And, you know, it should be said, a lot of these people are quite skilled when it comes to skiing or riding. You know, they have a high level of movement skills, but their avalanche understanding and their ability to use the terrain appropriately doesn't really match the skill they have of being able to ride the terrain.
Totally. I've seen the same thing. So yeah, I'd agree with you. And it's one of your pet peeves, certainly one of mine, are these terrible uptracks that get set by those people that don't have much experience in the mountains and don't really know how to use the terrain either from a safety standpoint or just a convenience standpoint.
Yes. You know, in fact, I'm glad you bring that up because that is something that whenever I'm teaching an avalanche course, you know, which has quite a bit of overlap, especially the early level avalanche courses tend to be people that are just getting into ski touring. So there's a lot of overlap with kind of an intro to backcountry skiing course. And I really encourage people during these courses, if they don't like the uptrack they're on, to just abandon it and make their own uptrack. So it's a common thing. People think, oh, it's so much work to break trail. And so they just follow any trail that's out there. And some of the trails that are out there, as you just described, are just horrible. And they don't often use the terrain the way they should. And what most people don't realize is that even if it is a little more work to break trail, in the end, the efficiency you gain from putting in an appropriate trail is often rewarded in the energy you save by not following a steep track that has a lot of kick turns. So it's usually going to be worth the effort.
Yeah, that has certainly been my experience at those. You know, there's this sense that I'm in a hurry. I want to get to up as fast as I can. And while that it can work for the first few people over that track, but once the track gets skied in a bit and gets a little glazed, then people's skin stop grabbing and it can be a lot of work to get up there. Yeah. And is the main thing you've seen the steepness or just also like, you know, poor terrain selection in the up track?
Yeah. You know, I would say it's a combination. You know, I remember the very first time I had the epiphany that we're talking about right now. I was out skiing with a few friends. This is 20 years ago now. And, you know, it's deep trail breaking and a local skier catches up to us, somebody we knew, but a guy we didn't ski with a lot. And he, you know, the guy was an incredibly fit athlete and he caught right up to us. And then he offered to take a turn breaking trail. And when we put him out front, he immediately flips up his risers and starts going steeply up the hill. And what started out as this enjoyable tour, suddenly, you know, we're all sweating and we're all fighting, not slipping backwards on the trail. And, you know, nobody's talking anymore. And finally, after like 30 minutes of this, we just decide, you know what, let's just go back to making our own trails. It's ridiculous. And this guy, to his credit, had just like dropped all of us. Even though he was breaking trail, we couldn't even keep up with him. And so we start breaking our own trail and now we're telling stories and laughing and having a great day again. And lo and behold, by the time we got to the top, we caught him. And that was when I had the epiphany of like, oh my gosh, you know, it's only quicker if you are climbing a short slope. If you are in it for the long haul, the low angle efficient track is going to be the way to go. And that what I've noticed recently, as the backcountry gets busier, what I think a lot of people don't realize is that uptracks tend to have quite a long lifespan. So in other words, if I put in a track going into first bowl, then, you know, it might snow 4 or 5 inches and then somebody goes in there tomorrow and they say, oh, here's an old track, and they re-break the track. And then people start using that track for a few days and now it's getting really beaten in. And then it snows another 10 inches and people go up there. It's like, oh, they sniff out, here's an old up track. And so a track that gets put in can sometimes last for weeks and weeks and weeks. And so the rule of thumb that we try to encourage people is that the uptrack should always utilize the safest terrain available, regardless of what the avalanche hazard is. You know, you can think about, you have the most vulnerability when you're on the uptrack, right? Your group is generally close together. People are stripped down to their lightest layers. Everyone that has tech bindings has their toes locked in into the ski. So if you are exposed to an avalanche, your group is in a really vulnerable position. So we address vulnerability by choosing the safest terrain available. So even on a low hazard day, I'm going to put my track in the safest available terrain. And that way, if my track has a, you know, a lifespan of 3 weeks, and 2 weeks later, now it's at considerable hazard, that uptrack should still be a good option for folks. And if I put in a nice low angle track, then even after people skinning on it for several weeks, it's not going to be too steep or too slippery, and thus it can have a good long lifespan. And I would say the vast minority of uptracks out there that I'm seeing fall into that category.
Yeah, I know that you and I used to grouse about that lots of when we would be out skiing and say, well, who the hell put this track in? And we, you know, as you call it, we would edit the track, we'd edit the uptrack. And you know, it doesn't take very long for people to catch on to that idea. But I just think with this, like I would say 10 or 15 years ago, the relatively small group of people that skied here at that time, which you probably could have been, you know, under a couple of dozen, I'm sure, were pretty well educated on that fact. But with this rise of popularity and these new people coming in that don't have that experience, and they're, like you said, not only do they not know that epiphany that you had, but they also don't know how to read mountain terrain. Like you said, they got very high downhill skiing abilities, but not necessarily a lot of, you know, mountain experience, and certainly mountain experience in avalanche terrain.
Yep. Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that lesson about the uptrack, it's something I actually learned from Steve years ago.
Steve House, this is.
Steve House, yeah. So Steve used to be the training director here at NCMG, my company. And I remember, you know, years ago when he was helping prep me for one of my ski exams, and he told me, I use this line all the time, and I do give him credit, so in case he's listening. he says, when your clients show up in the morning, they come with a certain amount of energy to spend for the day. And as a guide, it's your job to budget that energy. And so as a ski guide, the way you budget that energy is largely with the track you set. And so I have countless days under my belt where I've been able to like test this hypothesis of going into an area where there was an uptrack and we used an existing uptrack compared to a day where I put in a really good uptrack with the same guests. And I could see I could get so much more skiing out of those people when they were following the easier, lower angle, more moderate uptrack. And I think some people, especially people that are just getting into the sport, they really, you know, they enjoy the athletic challenge of going uphill, and they look at it as kind of a workout. Oh, I like to go as steep as I can because, you know, I really want to work hard. And I always tell people, you can still put in a good uptrack, just go faster. You don't have to go steeper. So, but yeah, I'm such a strong believer that it's so much more efficient to use a lower angle uptrack, and it'll just get you more skiing at the end of the day.
And for this, you know, newer audience that's coming into ski touring these days, other than like a basic avalanche course that will hopefully, if the instructors are good, give them some ideas on how to set an up track and how to choose the appropriate terrain. Are there any kind of like beginner ski touring courses out there that you know of?
Yeah, you know, a lot of guide services nowadays are offering introduction to backcountry ski courses. And while some of this stuff does get touched on in an avalanche course, there's so much in the curriculum of a 3-day level one avalanche course already that it can be really challenging to go too far into general backcountry touring skills. And it's one of the issues that we see sometimes. People think, I want to get into backcountry skiing, so the first thing I need to do is take an avalanche course. When I would argue the first thing you need to do is learn how to ski, because we do see plenty of people that, you know, because their ultimate goal is to backcountry ski, they feel like they need to take an avalanche course first. They can easily grasp the concepts of an avalanche course, but then they literally cannot ski downhill. So first step, learn how to ski.
And where, Larry, let me stop you there for a second. What you and I both know that maybe learning to ski in the backcountry is not the best way to do it, because you just don't get that much downhill. For all the time you're going to spend slogging uphill, you don't get to go down. So do you recommend that people, you know, go to downhill ski areas to do this?
Absolutely. Yes, that is by far and away the best place to learn the skiing skills. You know, if people don't really come from much of a ski background, I encourage people to buy a season pass at a ski hill and try to commit to getting, you know, 30, 50 days in over the course of a year. And I know it's a lot for a lot of people, but the thing with skiing is what it comes down to is it takes mileage and it takes enough repetition to create the muscle memory. Because as you're skiing down, you've got the snow changing under your boots every couple turns, and the terrain is constantly variable, and your body is moving through space, and sometimes you have a backpack on. And so you can't think quickly enough to make all these micro adjustments. Your body just has to learn how to do it, and it takes a lot of repetition. And as you just alluded to, you just cannot get that volume of repetition in the backcountry. You know, an average day of backcountry skiing, I would say is most people are going to ski between 3,000 and 5,000 or 6,000 feet, vertical feet. And, you know, at a lot of ski areas, that's one or two runs. You know, you can do 10, sometimes 20 runs a day at a ski area with high speed lifts. So you realize like you're just going to get so much more time spent working on the downhill portion at a ski area. And I would encourage people that are just getting into the sport as well to start out with some lessons. Like the earlier you start with ski lessons, so you're building a really strong foundation, the quicker you're going to develop as a skier. It's skiing is one of those things that if you teach yourself how to do it, your body is going to develop all these kind of bad habits and sort of workarounds for inefficiencies in your movement. And then hiring an instructor to get you to unlearn those things and reprogram your movement patterns is going to be way harder than investing a little bit of money at the beginning to getting a strong foundation.
I think that's, you know, the case with any high-skilled sport. You know, getting good instruction just speeds up the learning curve so much that then you can go out in the backcountry and enjoy yourself instead of going out there and falling with every turn and wondering why you can't do this and, you know, do I really suck that much as a skier? And I think, you know, I'm glad that we can talk about these things, because I think that's I know that you have spent a considerable amount of time and even some time with some of the uphill athletes that we have going skiing, taking them skiing, and in some cases finding out that, oh, let's just go to the local ski resort and do a few laps there. Then tomorrow we'll go into the backcountry. Yeah. And I can see that that has been really beneficial.
Yeah. There's, there's really no substitute for the kind of mileage you can get at a downhill ski area. And, you know, over the years, I've spent, at least 8 or 10 seasons working full time at ski areas. And, you know, when I look back at how much my skiing has progressed each of those years, and then it's pretty easy to take those skills and transfer them to the backcountry, because ultimately the movement patterns are the same, whether you're skiing, in knee deep powder or on perfect corduroy. It's just a slight different blending of the movement skills that you're using depending on the snow conditions. But, you know, the bulk of the movement patterns are the same. And, you know, what's interesting, one thing that came to my mind when you just mentioned that speeding up the learning curve is, now I have a young daughter and she's been on skis since she was, 2 years old. And she's been in lessons basically, since that age, or essentially from the time she was 3. And she's 8 years old now. And my wife can barely keep up with her, and she's a good skier. And the kid, you watch this kid flying down the ski hill, and she has perfect ski form because she never learned any bad habits. And it's amazing to see how just those lessons at an early stage of her, learning process has just transferred into this, incredibly efficient movement patterns. And now when I take her to the ski hill, all she wants to do is like ski the most challenging runs. And she wants to go off in the untracked snow. And she can just do that all day long. It's pretty fun.
It is. Yeah. It won't be before too long. You won't be able to keep up with her.
I know.
That's one of the beauties of learning these things as a child, because, your nervous system is so much more plastic at those ages, and you just get those skills ingrained. It's like the old adage about, learning to ride a bicycle and then never being, never not. I mean, she's going to know how to ski her entire, even if she didn't ski for the next 20 years, she will know how to ski for the rest of her life. And that's a cool thing. Let's talk about equipment a little bit, because I know there's been a big push in the last, probably you know better, but 15 years or so to avalanche packs that contain inflatable devices for avalanches. And I want to hear your opinion on them. And I want to know if you think that those give people a false sense of security.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So full disclosure, I use an avalanche airbag pack, and I probably have pretty consistently for 10 years now. The way I look at it is it's another tool. It's another layer of protection. So, I would guess a lot of your listeners are familiar with this idea of reasons model, or sort of the Swiss cheese model. I know it's been talked about a lot with COVID, as like, you want to give yourself all these layers of protection about something, and each layer is like a piece of Swiss cheese. And when you put all the pieces of Swiss cheese together, you're hoping that none of the holes line up so that something can go all the way through. And so that's the way I look at the airbag pack, is it's just another layer of protection. So I'm not going to let it affect my decision-making. I'm not going to ski a run because I have an airbag pack. I'm going to go through the same process in the morning of, looking at the weather, looking at the avalanche forecast, knowing what's going on with the snowpack. I'm going to look at who's in my group for the day. And then based on those factors, I'm going to choose some terrain that's appropriate given all those considerations. Once we get out into that terrain, we'll further make assessments of where exactly we want to ski. But, no matter how confident we are, we're generally always dealing with some amount of uncertainty. And so the way we manage uncertainty in the backcountry is by building some margins into our terrain. So for the more uncertainty we have, the more margin we want to give ourselves. But, you know, there's always a chance at some point, and, you know, many, many experts before me have proven that you're going to get it wrong sometimes. You're going to make a mistake. And you want to make sure that the consequences of that mistake don't necessarily cost you dearly. And so I look at that airbag pack as I'm going to do everything to the best of my ability, but then still, if I screw up or if I'm wrong or I underestimated something and I do get caught in an avalanche, I want to give myself one more chance of not getting buried by having that pack. And they're not foolproof, right? So, you know, they're not going to protect you from getting smacked into a tree, or they're not even going to keep you from getting buried every single time, but they're just going to make the likelihood that you'll come out on top much, much higher. So, you know, that all essentially has to be weighed against the cost of the pack. You know, they're not that cheap, $800. Some of them are close to $1,500. And then you're looking at an extra 4 to 5 pounds in an empty pack. So no matter how much you're carrying, it's going to be 4 or 5 pounds heavier. And that's where the technology is getting better. They're getting lighter and lighter. But you're still going to be looking at least a few pounds heavier than a typical ski touring pack. And so for me, when I do the math on that, you know, I would rather do a few more squats and just get in a little bit better shape and carry the extra weight for that ability to increase my likelihood of not getting buried.
And I fully concur with everything you've said. I think, but you're in a position as a professional and with, you know, many, many years of experience doing this, where you can view that pack as, and I'm not trying to be contentious here, and I don't really even have a strong opinion on this, but you, what you just explained to me, which completely makes sense, is, you know, that you're viewing it as just another tool, and it gives you a slight, a little bit bigger safety margin. But I'm just wondering if the people who aren't as educated as you are, don't have the experience that you have, maybe a little more cavalier with that approach of, you know, and I suppose, you know, that could vary a lot from person to person, but I can just sort of see that kind of thing happening. It's like, oh, and especially people who haven't actually seen the consequences of an avalanche before, that say, oh, well, fine, I've got this airbag, I'll be able to ride it out or whatever. So anyway, that's just a thought I had. I don't really know I'd come down on it.
Yeah, there is something to that. The concept of risk homeostasis, they say, you know, with things like seat belts and airbags and cars, you know, people have generally, while they have saved lives over the years, people have also engaged in riskier behavior. And so they've offset some of the potential benefits of some of those safety devices. So I do think there's certain population that, yeah, is more likely to engage in the kind of decision-making of, well, you know, I wouldn't normally ski this slope, but I have my airbag, so I think it'll be fine. And I'm not sure, you know, really how, what's going to change that sort of thought process. Ultimately, I would say, you know, based on what you just described, I have been doing this for a long time, and I understand the uncertainty that even people like me and people far smarter than me still deal with all the time. You know, the snowpack is just so variable over terrain that we're always dealing with a certain level of uncertainty. And so the people who don't even know how high their uncertainty is, they're the people that should have these packs more than anyone else, because they're far more likely to make those mistakes. That's, you know, in my mind, Scott, as the technology improves and as these packs get lighter, and over time, they'll will become less expensive. But my guess is that there'll be a point where the vast majority of the people will be wearing these packs. So it'll be sort of like beacon, shovel, probe, airbag pack. You know, we're starting to almost see that with helmets in the backcountry now. I'd say it's got to be close to 50%. And I would say it's somewhat geographic. Certain areas, I bet it's far more than 50% of the people are wearing helmets. But, you know, over the years, I've seen a dramatic increase in the use of helmets in the backcountry as well.
I said, I don't get out as much as you do. And I haven't been really active in the backcountry for a few years now. But when I am out there, I see helmets all the time now. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, you just almost never saw anyone with a helmet. That is an interesting, evolution. Well, I think the packs are a wonderful thing. I own one like you, and I appreciate that it could be a life-saving tool. I just was curious at your thoughts on that subject, whether you thought it might, you know, lead to riskier behavior. But we can leave that. I don't need a definitive answer. What about, you know, one of the things that I think you and I, when we used to ski together, you know, almost daily for many years, would see is people dressed really inappropriately for the activity. So give us your, you know, thumbnail sketch of what's good attire and not such good attire for this kind of sport.
Yeah. So one of my cardinal rules that I tell people that I ski tour with all the time is that you're not allowed to break a sweat in the backcountry unless you're down to your lightest layer of clothing. So if you think about it, we're out in the middle of winter. You know, it's usually well below freezing out. We are exercising, yes, but there's really no reason to be sweating in those cold temps unless we're overdressed. So I see the same thing all the time. People, you know, there's this misconception about Gore-Tex, for example, that it's breathable. And so you can sweat and somehow you're going to still miraculously stay dry. And I often tell people that Gore-Tex breathes far better when it's in the bottom of your backpack than when it's on your body. But ultimately, what I think people need to do is just get in that mindset of, I can't sweat out here, so I'm going to adjust my temperature with my clothing. And it's not a big deal. Like, I don't like to be cold. So I'm not one of those people that say, be bold, start cold. Like, I start with all my clothes on, but I get 5 minutes up the trail and I stop and I drop my pack and I peel off all my layers till I'm at a, you know, dressed appropriately. And that stop typically takes me about 30 seconds. And I will make up that 30 seconds really in probably the next 5 minutes of skinning when I'm dressed appropriately for the weather. So I just really encourage people, like, it's not a big deal to just stop and change your layers while you're moving. And if you're out with a group, you don't even need to stop the whole group. You just step out of the up track, adjust your layers as you need to, and then, you know, step back into the track and keep going. And one of the easiest ways to adjust layers is often with your, on your head and on your hands. So, you know, most of the time when I'm skiing, I'll have like a wool ski hat on. And one of the first things I do when I get warm is I just take that hat off and I'll shove it in a pocket. And you can dump a lot of heat out through your head. And if I'm still really warm, I'll often take my gloves and clip them onto a carabiner and clip it onto the waist belt of my pack, so I have them right there. And so those are some micro adjustments I can make without having to stop. But if I'm generally dressed correctly, but I still want to, you know, add or subtract a little heat, I'll often do that with, you know, gloves and a hat. And then whenever we stop to take a break, typically the very first thing I do is throw some clothes back on. So you've just worked hard to build up all this warmth. So you want to capture that warmth. So as soon as I stop for a transition or a break, get some food while we're skiing, first thing I'll do is put on a big puffy jacket, and I'll keep that on the whole time we're at a break. And the very last thing I'll do before we start skinning again is take it off and shove it in my pack. So ultimately, it just, once again, it comes down to efficiency. I'm trying to keep my body in its optimal operating temperature all day. So I don't want to be too hot or too cold.
And do you prefer for that big puffy jacket to be synthetic or down?
You know, I don't have a strong preference there. I would say when the temps are really cold, down is a great layer because it tends to be incredibly warm and it packs down even smaller than a synthetic jacket. But anytime the temps are anywhere near the freezing level or just tends to be like a really stormy, wet day where wetness might be an issue, the synthetic's going to do a lot better in those conditions. So I use both. I would say I tend to use the down when it's really considerably colder, and I use synthetics when it's, you know, closer to freezing.
Do you carry more than one pair of gloves for the day?
I do. Yeah. So I have a little, what I think of as kind of my emergency kit at the bottom of my backpack. And I keep an extra warm hat and I keep a pair of warm gloves. And those live in my pack for most of the time. It's rare that I tap into them, but, you know, so much of what we do outside, even when we're skiing, involves our hands, just our ability to, you know, take our skins on and off our skis, utilize our poles. Like you can't lose your hands. So if your hands get really cold and wet, you want to have a warm pair of gloves to put them into. And then the same thing with that wool hat. Like if it's really snowing hard, or, you know, if, let's say, the positive side, I'm getting lots of face shots that day and snow just billowing over my head all day and my hat gets completely soaked, I want to be able to put on something warm and dry on my head. So that's something I'll typically always have, is an extra hat and extra pair of warm gloves.
And I know you're a big fan of, like, for your outer layer of soft shell type of clothing rather than a harder shell. So do you want to talk a little bit? I mean, I guess you've already touched on that with the fact that Gore-Tex belongs in your pack until you desperately need it, because it doesn't breathe, as we know. I mean, even some of the soft shell thing fabrics don't breathe particularly well, but it certainly, that's something I've seen a lot in the mountains where people were skinning uphill with a Gore-Tex jacket and Gore-Tex pants on and just sweating like all get out.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things, as people are getting more and more into backcountry skiing, the thing to strive for is to develop systems in really everything you do. So you develop a system for packing, for your layering, for how you do your transitions, even how you dry your gear when you get home. And probably one of the most important things for just being comfortable out there is a good layering system. So, you know, I generally am a big fan of soft shell gear. That said, though, I've found as I've gotten older and I start to run, my body just runs a little bit colder all the time. I find when the temps are colder that I've been touring in hard shell pants more. Just because in my soft shell pants, I just, you know, I was having to adjust and wear so many clothes on my upper body that it just felt a little cumbersome. And when I put hard shell pants on the bottom, it made layering in my upper body easier. So, you know, I utilize both. When it's really cold, I'll often tour in hard shell pants. If it's a little bit warmer, or if I know I'm going to be working really hard, like breaking trail and it's deep snow, I'll often wear soft shell pants. And then I typically, you know, like everything we do in the mountains, we dress in layers. And what I found a good layering system for me is a really lightweight base layer followed by a really super thin and breathable windbreaker of some kind. And then over that, I'll have like a midweight layer and then a shell and then finally a big puffy. And I can put those on and take them off in that order that I just described. And many days I find I never make it down below that windbreaker layer. And it's really nice to have a bit of a windbreaker on when we're out in the mountains, unless it's a really warm day. There's typically always some kind of air movement, or it's, you know, snowing somewhat. And so I don't want to get my base layer soaking wet. And so having that windbreaker right over my lightest layer of clothing just often keeps me right in that sweet spot of, you know, being still very breathable, but shedding some wind and some of the precip that might fall on me.
Interesting. Great. Well, that's been really helpful. I want to be respectful of your time. I know it's closing in on dinner time and you've got a young daughter you need to attend to. So, but before we wrap up, are there some things that I've overlooked that you would like to talk about?
Yeah, you know, I guess there's a couple things to think about. You know, people often ask me why my pack is so heavy. And while I'm not encouraging people to carry heavy packs out there, I do think people should think about a number of things that you want to make sure you have within your group whenever you're out there skiing. So one of the first ones is obviously the first aid kit. And, you know, that we put this huge emphasis on people taking avalanche classes when in fact, if you successfully rescue someone from an avalanche, there is a really good chance they are going to be, at the best case scenario, hypothermic, worst case scenario, severely injured. And so having some first aid skills should be on everyone's mind as well. So, you know, if you're spending a lot of time in the winter backcountry and you feel like you've checked the box by taking your avalanche course, you should also really think about making sure that you've taken some kind of first aid course, wilderness first aid or wilderness first responder. Those are the kind of courses that are going to give you skills to deal with something that goes wrong in the backcountry and then give you the ability to actually use the first aid kit that somebody in your group should be carrying. The other thing that I've used far more times than I've used my first aid kit over the years is my repair kit. And so, you know, carrying a small supply of tools and items that you could fix broken bindings, broken ski poles, you know, broken skins, those can save the day out there. And I think probably one of the best bangs for the buck is the Humble Volley strap. If people ask me if there was just one piece of gear that I could carry to like MacGyver almost anything that could break in the backcountry, it would be a Volley strap. I've literally strapped somebody's boot onto a broken binding and had them ski 3,000 vertical feet down rugged mountainous terrain, and they said they could hardly tell the binding was broken. I've used them to repair, broken straps or buckles on boots. I've used them to strap skins on that stopped sticking or if somebody lost a tip clip or a tail clip. You can use them to lash skis on your pack. I mean, you can use them to build a splint. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So everyone should carry a couple of Volley straps in their backpack.
Like the backcountry duct tape.
Yes, basically it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great call. What about a rescue sled? Do you think that's something that's important to have in a group?
That's a good question. You know, it's something I generally always carry when I'm guiding, but, you know, and gosh, over 20 years of doing this, I've never had to put somebody in it. So I don't think it's something.
Wait a minute. I remember you pulling me down with some guides practice a few times where I had to be in the sled.
Okay. Fair enough. I've practiced.
I wasn't hurt though.
Extensively. Yes. But I've never had to actually put a patient in one. I don't think it's something that every backcountry skier, every group necessarily needs to carry. You know, it's not a bad idea for a group to consider having some kind of, you know, bivy sack or a tarp, something in the worst case scenario. If somebody was really injured, you could at least drag them out of the mountains. Or just the ability to MacGyver a sled together out of skis and poles. And there again, Volley straps are going to be the key to doing that. There are many tutorials online you can find for rigging something together. It's certainly not going to be as functional as, you know, a backcountry rescue sled that's manufactured. But, you know, in the worst case scenario, you could get somebody out on that. That does sort of bring up the idea of, you know, when things go terribly wrong out there, just having some ability to communicate with the outside world. So around here, our mountains, we don't have any kind of cell service whatsoever. I know there are plenty of mountainous areas around the country that are in that same situation. And so people should be thinking about, you know, some sort of satellite communication device. Nowadays, you know, the inReaches and spot devices have become pretty affordable, mm-hmm. especially if you sign up for just, you know, the basic emergency plan. So you're only planning to use this if things really go wrong. You know, it's really cheap insurance because like I just mentioned, if somebody in your party does get caught in an avalanche, even if you successfully rescue them, that could just be the very start of your problems.
Yeah. Well, that's great advice, I think, and good cautionary tale. Certainly, I agree with you completely on the whole, you know, satellite communication device. If you don't have access to some kind of a radio that will do the same kind of thing, keep you in communication with somebody out of the backcountry. But yeah, and that's, it's nice that those devices now exist, you know, and are quite affordable. So yeah, if you, a person can afford the thousands of dollars it costs to outfit them for real backcountry skiing, they can certainly afford a couple hundred dollars or whatever those things are to for the, that sort of insurance policy.
Yeah. And hearing you mention radio, Scott, you know, I just want to put in a quick plug there. It's something that's becoming much more common nowadays is user groups utilizing backcountry radios. They generally work on the family band channels. So, you know, historically we referred to those as like talk about radios, the ones mm-hmm. initially made popular by Motorola. Nowadays, BCA makes some called the BC Links, and they've gotten quite powerful. You know, they're 2-watt radio, so they transmit over quite a distance and have a ton of different channels, and they are incredibly effective at allowing your group to communicate even when you're essentially out of visual or certainly out of voice range. So, you know, one of the things that we do to stay safe in the backcountry is we often spread out or we only expose one person at a time to skiing an avalanche path. And when we do that, one of the downsides is we lose some of our ability to communicate. So when we have radios, we can maintain that communication while we get the group a little more spread out. And so we're seeing that more and more. I've been using radios when I guide for years, but we're seeing general backcountry skiers using those all the time now. And I just feel like they're such an incredible tool. They're both helpful in that somebody can ski down a run and then relay back information about, hey, you know, I just saw some cracking when I skied that run. You know, I advise you to take a safer route down. Or it could just be, hey, go even further right than where I went. There's a beautiful line through the trees. You can use them to steer people into, you know, really nice terrain. They're super helpful if you're trying to set up photographs. You can get down there, get all ready, and then call people down, tell them where you want them to go. So they just have a myriad of uses, and certainly safety being one of them. Some areas are even starting to designate some, you know, popular backcountry skiing zones like the Wasatch and parts of Colorado, even Snoqualmie Pass here in Washington, where they're designating a standard channel for all ski tours in that area. So if you're getting ready to drop into, say, you know, a popular couloir, and you're not sure if there are people in there below you, you could get on the designated channel for your region and say, hey, you know, this is Larry. We're getting ready to drop into the slot couloir. Are there any other skiers down there below me? And if there are other skiers on that channel, they could say, yeah, we're in there right now. Give us 10 minutes and we'll relay when we're clear at the bottom. So that's becoming a much more common thing.
That's a great thing. Yeah, that's wonderful to see. I'm familiar with those talkabouts, but they weren't the greatest. So I'm glad to hear they've been improved. Yeah. Well, Larry, thanks very much for taking the time this afternoon to have this chat with me. I really appreciate it.
And yeah, absolutely.
People want to get a hold of you, Larry. They can do it through North Cascades Mountain Guides. That's probably the easiest way, right? What's your email there?
Yeah. Yep. That is the easiest way to get a hold of email is through there, Larry at ncmountainguides.com.
Yeah. Great. Okay, good. Well, thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And again.
Thanks for joining us today. For more information about what we do, please go to our website, uphillathlete.com.